welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hey, Tim.
Hey.
It's about time that we revisit with an old friend of ours. It's been a while since he's been on the show with us. Mm-hmm. But Steve Jackson is back. His book, No Angels, The Short Life and Brutal Death of Brandolene Rose Duvall. The paperback version, new version, is out July 17th, 2020. We have a link for that on today's program guide, so you can find more information about the book. Make sure that if you do order it, you do go out and rate and review it afterwards. Steve Jackson, welcome back to the show, sir. Good to catch up with you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me back again. I've always enjoyed doing your show.
Well, it's been quite a while, and for our listeners that may be new or unfamiliar with Steve, he is a New York Times bestselling author and award-winning journalist. He's written 11 nonfiction books in true crime, history, and biography genres, and he's also written 16 crime fiction thrillers for the long-running New York Times bestselling Butch Karp series in collaboration with former New York Assistant District Attorney Robert Tannenbaum. He is back with us to talk about this, and this case means something to you, doesn't it, Steve?
Yeah, this one in particular. It was essentially about 2 years of from everything from the crime through four different murder hearings, two different death penalty hearings, several other associated trials. So. It was about 2 years of my life. Obviously, not just the only thing I did, but it really did affect me in many ways.
Well, introduce us, if you would, to Brandy Duvall. Tell us a little bit about her life prior to May
30th, 1997. Her life prior to that date or mine?
her life. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about Brandy and fill us in on her story.
Sorry about that. Brandy was a 14-year-old girl living in Denver with her mother, got a brother, and also lived with her grandparents. She was, by all definitions, a very engaging, active 14-year-old, loved Michael Jordan, wore his jersey, his red jersey, all the time, which in this case would not be a good thing. But, loved basketball, played basketball, was athletic, likable, and just your normal 14-year-old. Now, she came from a family, a split family, and, may have done a little bit of wandering around at night without supervision, but, that's all hindsight, too.
In her life, did she stray? Did she get involved in anything that she probably should have avoided?
Well, yeah, I mean, she had smoked marijuana, as many do by that age. Probably had beer before, but there was no indication that she was involved with gangs or, the criminal life or anything else like that. She was kind of a typical teenager living in Denver. That's about what I can say for that. She was no angel herself, I guess, but not many teens are.
Does she have close friends, boyfriends, people like that, that she normally hangs around with, or is she kind of a loner? What do we know about her personally?
Yeah, she had a quite a number of friends. In fact, that night, the night in question, she was on her way home. She had spent the evening and night just hanging out with one of her good friends. She had a number of friends. She wasn't your popular kid at school. So her friends were the sort that she would go and spend several hours with them. And she left her friend's house about midnight and was waiting at a bus stop for the bus to come. when all of this began.
All right, so she leaves this party. She's on her way. Does she have any concept of issues? Was there anybody at the party that had been causing problems for her, or you know, picking fights, anything like that?
Oh no, yeah. Where she was, it was just, it wasn't really a party. She was just hanging out with a friend. She left that friend and was, like I said, trying to make her way back to her mom and her grandparents. She's very, very close to her grandparents. They had a large role in raising her. So she was just basically on her way home.
All right. Now, what do we know about her leaving and what unfolds next?
Well, Brandy is basically at the bus stop, and she's wearing her red Michael Jordan jersey. You know, a car drives by, and in this car, there are some younger members of a gang, the Bloods, and of course, the red attracts their attention right away. So they circle the block, and what happens next, we're not absolutely sure. It never really came out at the trials. There's varying stories. But she either voluntarily got in the car to go to a party, as some of them claimed, or she was forced into the car or abducted, or there's also the possibility she was, you know, she got high with these guys and got in the car, and then next thing she knows, she's being spirited off to this other party where the older members of the gang were.
Now, can you talk to us a little bit about the Bloods and, you know, this red affiliation? Just because somebody's wearing red, that automatically attracts them? Is it like they're treading on their territory by doing something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, in a way. I mean, we've all heard, you know, the Crips, it's the blue, and the Bloods, it's the red, and then when you're in their territory and you're wearing what they consider their colors, then that's going to attract them. For one thing, they may want to know if you're in with the group. There are, just because, like the Bloods in Denver, it's not like one big homogenous group. These guys were the D7 Bloods, which comes from the number 27 on a house of two of the founding members of the group. There are Crenshaw Mafia Bloods, which are out of L.A., and some of them had made their way to Denver as well. So these aren't necessarily, this isn't a big homogenous group, and sometimes within this group they even fight. But so this was a, you know, sort of a, it's different than wearing black or green or something else. So yes, they saw it, and they were all outfitted in red themselves, red hats, red bandanas, red shirts, that whole thing.
Now, the point of exactly how this all goes down, kind of up for discussion, but she gets in this car, she's taken to this party where the older members are. What happens next?
Well, she's sort of brought into the party. Brandy was quite tiny. She was, forgetting her exact height, but not much over 5 foot, and 100 pounds soaking wet or so. And she was brought in, sort of carried in by one of the gang members, and who announced that she was down, as they say, to, snort some cocaine and have sex with other members of the party. Again, this is coming from their mouth during the trial. We have no idea and no witness to say that, you know, this was her choice, that she wasn't being abducted, that she wasn't brought involuntarily. But at least at this point, there were some other women at this party. They left soon afterwards when things started to go bad with Brandy. But we have nothing more than some of these gang members who later testified at the trial as far as what Brandy was thinking or doing at this time.
Well, when you talk about other people being at the party and they start leaving when things are going bad with Brandy, what type of things specifically start going off the rails?
Well, she's given some cocaine, and then she is taken to a back room by some of the older members of the gang. These guys are in their later 20s. They're much rougher, have much more violence in their background, particularly one of them, Francisco Pancho Martinez, and he's with his best friend, Danny Martinez, no relationship. Danny and his brother Antonio and Pancho had all started the Do Seven Bloods some years before this. Antonio had been at the party earlier that night, but he was breaking away from the gang. He actually wanted to make something of his life and saw the gang spiraling down, trying to get his brother out of it and Pancho out of it. But anyway, he walks, and so he's not there. But Pancho and Danny take her into a back room and sexually assault her. She's 14 years old, so obviously it's sexual assault no matter whether she's complying or not, but it soon becomes something much worse than even just sexual assault.
Now, did these other women that were there and eventually ended up leaving, did they testify to her willingness? Not that I'm trying to okay any of this, but just so we have a different aspect of what was being told and experienced at that time.
Well, no, there's at some point during this, and some of this, I mean, this goes on for several hours. She's sexually assaulted. She is physically assaulted. She is tortured. And they're at this party. This party is actually happening at the house of one of the uncles of Danny Martinez. His name is Jose. And he claims to have been sleeping during part of this and only wakes up when he hears some commotion going on. And he comes out and sees that these guys are sexually assaulting and torturing this young girl. He does nothing about it, basically. He says he was afraid, and these guys, his quote in the trial was, had the devil in them, and these sorts of things. But no, so he did nothing except for go back into his room and shut the door.
And that's it. But by doing that and not trying to help, does he become complicit in this crime?
Well, I would think so. It's his house, for one thing. I think, how does any human being stand by, fear or not, and watch this sort of thing happen? And by this time, there are others involved. There's a young man named Sam Quintana, who was related to the Danny and Antonio. Now, his dad was a sheriff deputy at the jail in Denver, and had lived a different life than some of these others. Most of these guys, Danny and Antonio and Pancho, were from a very hard neighborhood where gang life was pretty common. Sam was out in the suburbs, and, you know, kind of a soccer kid, and had all these sorts of things. And but, you know, he wanted to get in with the gang like his cousins and be a tough guy. So he participates in the rape and torture. A couple of the younger members of the gang who brought her in the first place, they participate. So this is basically, you know, a bunch of predators are at this 14-year-old girl who is asking at one point in this that she be taken to the hospital and that she be let go and that there's, you know, she won't tell and all these sorts of things. So basically she's at a point where she's pleading for her life and pleading to be taken to the hospital. This is after this has gone on for a couple of hours.
Oh my God, how heartbreaking. What And how long is she actually gone for? And you know, where can we unfortunately see this story, you know, start to unravel even further?
Well, after a couple of hours, the gang, you know, is done with her, and now they're at the point of what do we do about her? So they bring her out, and basically she's in the living room having to listen to them have a conference on what to do about her. Sam Quintana goes and gets some wires that are used for a PlayStation, I guess, and wants to strangle her there. Now, by this time, the uncle, Jose, has come out of his bedroom and told them to get out and to take her to the hospital and to let her go. Unfortunately, one of the gang members, I believe it was Danny, asked if she knew where she was. And unfortunately, Brandy said that she did that and gave the address and the street for where she was and sealed her fate with this, because at this point the gang is unwilling to let her go or do anything humane about this.
And do we know what it was that finally took her life, or how that was done?
Yes, she was put in the car with Pancho Martinez and Danny Martinez and Sam Quintana. I believe Frank V. Hill was there, but there were some were following them, some members of the gang. The younger guys were following them, and they sort of turned off. So the older members, they took her up into the mountains west of Denver, a little ways up, probably about 15 miles up a fairly, it's a road that leads to Blackhawk and the central city, which are gambling towns. So there's usually some traffic on this road, but this is very late at night. Now we're talking 2 or 3 a.m. This has gone on for a while. And so Brandy's in the back seat between a couple of them. Poncho's in the front with Danny. At some point, she's pleading to be let go. She's wants to be taken to a hospital or taken to her mom. Instead, Poncho turns around and stabs her a couple of times with a knife. And so this torment continues until they reach a place in the mountains, on an embankment above a stream, and they pull her from the car. And at that point, Sam Quintana and Francisco Pancho Martinez in particular stabbed her numerous dozens of times, and then basically shoved her down the embankment, and then they drove off and went back to Denver.
Just a pack of wild animals. That's what it is.
Yeah, that's one description. I think that you're insulting animals.
That's true. That's true.
But, yeah, these are, this is an inhuman act committed, you know, by evil men who thought they had the right to do this to another human being, and particularly, a young teenage girl who, you know, should be about 37 years old now with children of her own and living her life, but they decided they had the right to take hers.
How long was she considered missing before they eventually realized that she had been murdered?
Well, her mom had been frantically trying to text her and call her for some time during this, and her grandparents and people. So they're pretty frantic, you know, when she doesn't arrive home from after going to the bus stop. And but it's the next day, some tourists are driving along this road. It's a beautiful highway up through the mountains next to this beautiful stream. And they stop basically to possibly go dip their feet in the stream. And one of them spots what he thinks is a half-nude body down by the stream. And it's Brandy, who had not died right away. She had struggled to live and tried to crawl up the embankment, but eventually bled out and died down there. So he's spotted. It takes him a little bit of time to get some cell service in order to get police officers up there. But so she's found that day.
Wow. How quickly does this puzzle start to get put together then? I mean, how do we know who picked her up, where she went and everything, if she just kind of left her friend's house and that was it?
Find out that there's been a girl murdered and she's in the mountains. Her body is found in the mountains. And the police get a couple of anonymous calls that, that this was believed to be this, teenage girl who had been brought to this party, and it starts to unravel from there. The police actually managed to find the house, and they talked to Jose Martinez, the uncle. And at first he's saying he doesn't know anything about any of this. And then he finally breaks down and starts talking about how, you know, these guys, they had the devil in them, and they did this horrible things to this girl. And he tried to stop them, which there's no evidence he made any attempt to try to stop them. And he had kept Brandy had a prayer card with her belongings. And most of the rest of it, the gang had come back and got rid of the bloody mattress and some other evidence and kind of wiped the place clean to a degree. But Jose had found the prayer card, and whether it was just so he would have a trump card to play when the cops came over, or he was just superstitiously grabbed the prayer card. But he kept it, and he had hidden it in his underneath his kitchen sink, and he brought that out to the police. And from there, they learned that both Jose's one of his nephews, as well as Sam Quintana, and somebody he knew as Pancho, had been there that night. And so the police basically started tracking these guys down. Now, Danny Martinez and Pancho, those guys went on the run. They got to Sam Quintana and found out that he was also suspected in another murder that had happened some months before this, of a young woman who'd been in an apartment where some members of the gang, Sam and another guy named Alejandro Ornelas, believed a police informant was hiding out. So they came up to the door and basically sprayed the apartment down with semi-automatic rifle fire, and they killed this young 21-year-old woman before this. So they already had Sam, and we're looking at Sam for that. Then that led to Brandy, and Sam broke fairly quickly. He's a lot of the gang, they were, sticking with the don't talk to the police, don't say anything. The word went out that nobody was to snitch and that sort of thing. But Sam Quintana started talking and, obviously looking for a deal fairly quickly.
Is that common in these type of groups that you're going to have this kind of we always hear that they're pretty tight-lipped and protect each other to the end, but this seems like it was a pretty quick rollover.
Yeah, it took a matter of, it wasn't like the next day, but it was fairly quickly once they started turning people over, and Sam Quintana started talking, and they reached some of the younger guys who were also hoping to get to some of this. We always hear this, whether it's the Italian mafia or gangs like this or just criminals, you know, they have this code. Well, you know, code is pretty much bullshit. You know, as soon as they start getting in trouble, they start running like rats. There are a few who will stick to it. And in the case of Pancho and Danny, neither of them would turn on each other. And those two were facing the death penalty hearings. I would say more often than not, they pretty much just will eventually turn on themselves. They get, you know, start thinking about life without parole behind bars or the death penalty or any of these other sorts of things, and they start talking.
You had said that there were all these different theories of how she went along for this ride. Was it, you know, did she go willingly? Was she abducted? Was she promised drugs? You know, what all was happened? Was that because there were so many different versions that these gang members told?
Well, some of the young guys, they said that she got in the car voluntarily. Because, of course, otherwise, if they say something different, there's a kidnapping charge now. You know, so if they say she got in the car voluntarily and they took her to this house and she was down to do all these things and then things got out of control, well, that certainly reduces their culpability, their criminal culpability. They, you know, there's no longer an abduction charge there. There's, and some of those other sorts of things. So who knows? I have a hard time thinking that, well, I simply don't believe that a 14-year-old would be down to be taken to a house where she's given drugs and gang raped and tortured. I mean, the whole scene, and I'll leave that for anybody who wants to get into the book, but was probably as brutal as anything I've ever witnessed. And I've been all over the world and I've witnessed a lot.
Once they have their perps and they know who is reportedly responsible, how quick do arrests start to take place and how quickly do we go to court over this case?
The arrests start happening fairly quickly, like with Sam and some of the younger guys. Like I said, Danny Martinez went on the run and Pancho Martinez went on the run, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, and some of this I wrote quite a long time ago, actually it did something violent that got him arrested. And then, of course, then they were looking for him by that time. Jose Martinez, he's arrested, but he's going to be a prosecution informant. So, he didn't have much on that one. He becomes a CI and they actually put him in witness protection. So a lot of this starts to fall apart fairly quickly. The first trial was about 6 months after the murder. But of course there are multiple hearings. You have, there were, including the Venus Montoya murder, which was linked. They actually started the trials on Brandy, started the first one against the youngest member who was accused of murder, which is Frank Vigil, who was 16, I believe, at the time of the murder. And they go for that one. Now, that's not a death penalty, but they convict him and get life without parole. And then they switch over to Alejandro Ornelas, for the murder of Venus Montoya, because now they are starting to wrap the two in together. They're also, Sam Quintana has turned confidential informant. He pleads guilty to murder of Brandy, but it's with the understanding that he may be paroled, you know, with 48 years, not all of it necessarily. Well, for sure, not life without parole, but with possibility of parole, two sentences. I believe he's also convicted for Venus's murder. So in a way, it's sort of the guy, the one guy who was involved in two murders got the lightest sentence. But anyway, so the first trial starts about 6 months after Brandy's murder.
Well, walk us through that, though. I mean, Steve, to be involved in two murders and get this light sentence, I know myself and listeners around the world are shaking their head right now. How is that even possible?
Well, basically, the prosecution argument is that they needed Quintana to talk. Danny's not going to talk. Pancho's not going to talk. Frank Vigil, for all of being very young, wasn't going to talk. And Alejandro Ornelas, who wasn't there for the murder of Brandy but was involved in the Venus Montoya murder, he's not going to talk. Those are all pretty hardcore gang members, and they are not talking. So basically, the prosecution felt they needed Sam Quintana to tie it all together for them, including the Venus Montoya murder and Brandy's murder, because he's kind of got the oversight of both of these. Originally, I called this series Dealing with the Devil, and that was used in court basically to describe Sam Quintana, is that they had to make a deal with the devil in order to bring these other cases to conviction. The No Angels, the title of the actual book, is that crimes committed in hell don't have angels as witnesses. And that was the argument for the prosecutors, because they knew they were going to have to overcome the defense attorney saying, hey, you know, Sam Quintana is the guy who, you know, did all of this stuff. The other guys are around, but Sam Quintana is the actual worst guy there. And so the prosecution they both used that quote on No Angels, but they also would then follow it up with, we had to make a deal with the devil.
And what a deal they strike. How long do each one of these court cases take?
The actual trials went on for a couple of weeks each. They had to repeat everything. I mean, it was like a bad version of Groundhog Day, because they would always start the same way. They would have basically the same opening, which the prosecution would briefly tell what happened. The defense attorney would make his opening statement on how they were going to play it. And then the prosecution would call Brandy's mom, Angela Metzger, to the stand, and she would have to testify about how her daughter was out and that she couldn't reach her, and then she gets the call and has to go down to the morgue. And it was always very gripping, and it was done time after time. It was done, I believe, six different trials, and identify her daughter there on the gurney. And then they would hand her the effects that they had taken off some of the gang members, a small ring and a necklace, the prayer card that Jose Martinez had secreted, and she would have to identify them. And it was always a very emotionally tough. She would broke down every time. It didn't get any easier for her. Didn't get much easier for anyone listening. And the prosecutors would then go into their part of the trial and move through both how Brandy was found, the autopsy, and the number of stab wounds, and some of the evidence of the sexual assault. And these sorts of things, and then break down who did what and all of that. And then, of course, the defense would get up there and start their part. So it was like watching the same trial over and over again, particularly with Frank V. Hill, Danny Martinez, and Francisco Martinez trials, because they were all first-degree murder trials, and two of them were death penalty hearings, had death penalty hearings afterwards.
Do any of them ever end up copping to it to try to get lower sentences or different sentences, or do they all go down being tough guys?
They pretty much all go down being tough guys. You know, they did the usual thing at sentencing about how they had regrets that it all happened. Nobody really went into, I did this and I did that and I feel terrible about it. They mostly talked about, you know, they're sorry that it happened and it shouldn't have happened and all of that sort of thing. But, you know, yeah, I can't tell you how many murder sentences I've heard where suddenly the defendant is sorry and basically reads whatever his defense attorney wrote for him.
That's obviously heartbreaking that, you know, it's just this callousness of the nature. And obviously, if there were two murders associated with these people, there's got to be so many more untold that we just don't have any idea about. Did they address that at all and try to strike deals to see if they'd give them any more information about other missing children, girls, especially in that area?
No, not that I'm aware of anyway. You know, they were, the Deuce 7 Bloods were a small, but a fairly violent, group, gang. They were, you know, Danny's nickname was, Bang, and his brother Antonio's nickname was Boom. And I'll leave it for the readers to guess, where that comes from. But there's no other, and I should point out that while Antonio, when he was very young, shot somebody who was running away from him and went to juvenile delinquent, juvenile detention, he hasn't been charged, to my knowledge, with any other sort of major crimes, and hopefully he's living somewhere else and doing well. I mean, not that to excuse him from anything he may have done in the past, but I know of no other things in the past. And, you know, it was, you know, by the grace of God, he walked away that night. But he also made a choice. You know, he made a choice that he wasn't going to be involved anymore. And he didn't like where this stuff was going. And, you know, now, you know, maybe if he had been there that night, and he's talked to me about this before, is, maybe he could have stopped it all and saved the girl and saved his brother and his friends. But I don't know. One thing, of all of these gang members, Francisco Pancho Martinez struck me as the one who was wired to have done something like this at some point in his life. You know, there are different kinds of killers. They were all evil. This is an evil, horrible thing, and they all need to pay for it, and they're paying for it for the rest of their lives. But, you know, Danny Martinez, could he have gone some other way if, you know, he hadn't been wrapped up in the gangs? Could Frank Vigil have turned out differently? You know, possibly, but, Pancho was always violent. He's known to have shot people. He's been shot himself. He was just one of those that there are levels. There are different shades of gray, and his is a very, very dark shade of gray.
When you have to kind of arrest yourself to full involvement in researching this and following this case from start to finish, Steve, what is that like for you as a journalist?
Well, this one, I have to say, basically this one sent me into a pretty good tailspin. I was tired of listening to moms crying on the witness stand. I got, when I started writing this, I actually you often, as a journalist, you know, you kind of cover things from the prosecution point of view. The family you talk to intends to be the family or the mother of the victim only. And at a point early on in this, I noticed a woman who was always kind of off by herself and looked alone and frightened. And I asked who she was and found out that she was the mother of Danny and Antonio Martinez. And so I approached her and asked if she would talk about this, because it's a deeper story than one night when you know, these guys committed these inhuman acts on a young girl. And so I've always been fascinated by the effect of violence in our society and the ripple effect in particular of all the people who get swept under these waves that come from this stone that gets thrown into the pond. And so I started talking to her and realized that, you know, here was a mom who remembered her son as the 5-year-old who snuck into his Christmas presents, and her two boys who liked to go fishing and couldn't wait to go outside during the summer. And to me, it was a, you know, a reminder that, you know, Danny Martinez deserves to spend the rest of his life in prison without parole. He managed to escape the death penalty, and actually Francisco Pancho was sentenced to die, but the laws with death penalty were overturned, the one they were sentenced under, and so all of them, he and Danny, both are in prison for life without parole. But you know, so I have you know, absolutely no empathy or sympathy for those guys. You know, that's they behaved in a way that was worse than any animal we might imagine, and whatever happens to them, I'm fine with it. But having said that, I did find some empathy and some sympathy for their mother, of Danny, in that she had made her mistakes as a mom. She had got involved in drugs. She was from that same hard neighborhood. There had been a chance where she was married to a good man who was a good role model for the boys. And you kind of see that if you look at these things and you see these paths that diverge. And one path leads to eventually that horrible night for Brandlin Rose Duvall. Another path leads to, you know, two young men growing up, having children, having jobs, their mother being a grandmother, you know, the path they went on led to this horror. But at the same time, that's, you know, when you're the mom or the dad of these men, you know, you think back to at what point did that path diverge? If I had stayed, and this was her talking to me, if she'd stayed with this one man who was a good role model, and you know, would things have turned out differently? But she didn't. She left him and returned to sort of her old life, even though she actually worked very hard to try to get them out of the gangs once they started getting older, and she recognized what things in her past she had done to doom her own boys. So there is that. You know, you can't say, well, you had no role in what happened, because as parents, we are responsible to a degree to how our children turn out, you know, but not ultimately responsible. These guys were all, you know, in their 20s, They are the ones who made the choices, not their mother. But it was still very tough on me to deal with all of this suffering. And she was one person, but there were a number of families there who, hated to see what happened or hear what happened to Brandy, and recognized that their sons and brothers were involved, and that justice needed to be meted out. But at the same time, do you stop loving someone even when they've committed an evil act? So it was tough. It was.
Yeah.
It sent me away from true crime for a couple of years.
I can only guess. Amazing story. No Angels, the Short Life and Brutal Death of Brandolyn Rose Duvall. We have a link up for that book in today's program guide so you can find it, order it. Make sure that you do rate and review it as well. Steve, it was great catching up with you again, sir. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, David. And thanks for the opportunity.
We'd love to chat with you again more. Reach out to me when your next book is hitting the shelves, would you?
I will. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, kids. You know what that means. Time now to kick open the case files of dumb crimes, stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim. They want it. They're going to get it. I know there was some grumblings last week because we played a really cool episode. It was much longer. I think it was at almost 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
Right. Yeah.
But we didn't include dumb crime, stupid criminals.
No.
And there's a contingent that got very upset. We're going to deliver those now. It was just with what we had last week. We felt that 2 hour, 20 minute was kind of heavy already. We didn't want to add more to that.
Yeah. It was action packed and there's lots of stuff in there. Lots of good stuff.
Yeah, so this week we're back. We've got some dumb crimes, stupid criminals, and just some bizarre crimes I'm going to start off with. How about this one? Devender Sharma, a qualified doctor, finally admitted his brutal past after he was traced by police in India after he vanished while he was out on parole. Huh? That's a good little link to get you in. Wait till you hear what this guy did.
Okay.
He's a serial killer that's murdered more than 50 taxi drivers.
Jeez.
And then dumped their bodies in crocodile-infested waters so that he could turn around and sell their cabs.
Huh.
Yeah, evil Dr. Devender Sharma and his accomplices killed their victims in secluded places, then disposed of the bodies to ensure they were never found. Police in India say he was finally caught after vanishing while on parole, and he confessed to the crimes. But investigators believe Sharma may be responsible for upwards of 100 murders. The qualified doctor, who is now 62, was part of a syndicate which carried out illegal kidney transplants back in the early 2000s. He later admitted carrying out 125 procedures, making a profit of £7,000 each time.
Jeez.
So that's what a value of a life is, Tim. $7,000 to this scumbag. After losing money in a scam, he also began leading a group which robbed gas canisters from trucks, often killing the drivers. Oh, no, he got screwed in a scam, Tim. So he was only doing what he had to do, to go out and earn and get that money back in, killing more people.
Hmm.
Deputy Police Commissioner Rakesh Pawiara told the Times of India that he targeted taxi drivers so they could sell their cars either in whole or for parts. And truck drivers were also killed by the group. The police officer said his accomplices robbed trucks carrying LPG cylinders just by killing the drivers. they would unload the trucks in his fake gas agency, and then the robbed truck would be dismantled in Meerut, and the bodies of the bus drivers or the truck drivers were dumped in Hazara Canal, which has crocodiles. So there was no chance of retrieving the bodies. He had previously been convicted of 7 murders of taxi drivers carried out between 2002 and 2004 and jailed for life in Jaipur, Rajasthan. However, after 16 years, Tim, he was granted permission to spend 20 days on parole.
Oh, no.
And that's when he vanished, only to be traced to the home of a widow close to Delhi, local media reports. He said he'd had no intention of returning to jail and finally confessed to his entire brutal past. Why, if this man has murdered all of these people, why would you let him out? Why would you give him a 20-day furlough?
That's confusing, to say the least. Yeah.
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 Well, here's a tale that'll get you, Tim.
Okay.
The dismembered body of a popular rap singer was found in his flat in Russia after his wife reportedly chopped up his body and cleaned his organs in a washing machine and then sprinkled them with salt. Known as Andy Cartwright, age 30, his wife claimed he had died of a drug overdose in St. Petersburg. Marina Kakal, 36, told detectives that she did not want his fans to know he had died such an inglorious death and dismembered his body over 4 days, storing body parts in black plastic bags in her fridge. The limbs were reportedly sawn perfectly and the body parts sprinkled with salt.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah. Kakal used a knife, hammer, hacksaw, plastic bowl, and chopping board. Police say the couple's 2-year-old child was in the same flat as she severed the singer's body parts. Russian police say they've opened a murder probe into the death of the star, whose real name is Alexander Yashko, originally from the Ukraine. Today, new shocking claims reported by Baza news outlet suggested the rapper's internal organs were cleaned in a washing machine by his wife after the body was dismembered. The limbs were sawn perfectly. The body parts were sprinkled with salt. In addition, the investigators found traces of male hands on one of the forearms, as if the victim had been grabbed, said a report citing unnamed law enforcement sources. The widow had also thoroughly cleaned their apartment on Main Street. The man's friend said he had alcohol problems but did not take drugs. Reports also claim that the woman's mother had assisted her at the apartment. The woman's lawyer, Irina Skaturu, who had urged the wife to go to the police over the dismembering, denied reports that she put body parts in the washing machine. That's where she's going to draw the line, Tim. That would just make her sound crazy.
Well, you know, you don't want to ruin a good washing machine, Dave. They're expensive. Yeah.
She also disputed that the rapper's mother-in-law had been involved. The unnamed mother-in-law has been ordered not to leave St. Petersburg, say the reports. Newspaper Kamskaya Pravda.
Exactly.
Tim.
Pravda. Yeah.
Said no drugs were found on the rapper's body. The widow was detained. She's expected to undergo a polygraph test as part of a murder probe. She claimed she found a syringe next to his body. He had become addicted to hard drugs during the pandemic, she told his fans on social media. Forensic tests are underway in an attempt to establish the cause of death, which is going to be hard if she did, in fact, wash his internal organs. That's going to influence it with a bunch of different chemicals. What a weird story.
Wifey is more hardcore than he was.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Listen, it's got to be done. I can't have him, you know, his fans to realize he died in such an inglorious way. So it's best for me to dismember, clean his body parts, salt them, and keep them in my fridge. That's how his fans would like him to be remembered.
I mean, it takes all that Eminem, you know, tie her up in the trunk and drive her off a bridge stuff. It makes all that stuff look, you know, like Fisher Price stuff. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Huh.
Not that we're condoning any of those
actions. No, we're not condoning any of those actions whatsoever, but I mean, what she did was a whole new level.
But I am condoning the actions of this woman. A Florida flight attendant soared with rage after walking in on her cheating husband. Nicole Dennison, 29, allegedly struck her unfaithful hubby while also striking a chord. How so, you say? By smashing his acoustic guitar when she returned to their home late Wednesday at about 11 p.m. to find him in the middle of a sexual encounter, Florida police said. Dennison punched her husband in the face, causing a black eye, scratched up his face, and bruised his right arm, according to police records. The flight attendant then allegedly turned to his guitar, destroying the instrument when she smashed it against a wall, knocking down shelving and leaving a gaping hole, according to the arrest affidavit. Dennison was arrested this Wednesday, a week after the incident, and charged with domestic battery. She works for Allegiant Air. She has two children with her husband for nearly 3 years, a bartender and fitness instructor, according to the Smoking Gun. And she does look fit. I would not want this woman kicking my ass because I'm pretty sure she'd pound me into clay.
Yeah, it'd probably take the guitar out of her hands too then. Yeah.
But the good news is, Tim,
yeah,
she's single and ready to mingle. So give Tim a call at 612.
Dave, if what? You don't want to tussle with her, I don't want to tussle with her because
you're much tougher than I am, though. No, you like a woman with a little fight in them.
Well, Dave, let's consider the circumstances now. Uh-huh. I don't have two good legs to run away on. You do. I have suffered.
I don't know that I have two good legs. I have two legs.
Well, you can get away a little faster than I can. I can't. Second, I've suffered a lot of physical pain in my life. I don't need to be beaten up yet again.
Just still don't cheat on her while she's off working.
She sounds like she could go off at any time for any reason. I don't need that kind of crazy in my life. I
disagree, buddy.
No, what? You'd like to see me beaten randomly?
Again, she doesn't sound like she'd just go off. She came home
to
find him in the middle of a sexual tryst. I think, Tim, if I came home early from work and found you in the middle of a sexual tryst with someone else, I might get upset as well. I mean, if you and I were a couple.
Well, but you wouldn't stand up and applaud and be like, good job, buddy. You're independent.
Crack you over the noggin with a guitar. I'd El Cabong you. Yeah, El Cabong.
Not a hey. You know what? You're successful. You're getting out there. You're meeting people. It's a networking thing. Maybe I'm doing it for the show.
You're doing it for the show.
Maybe
I got to hear that negotiation tactic. We should try that. Maybe that'll get the show out there even bigger.
Maybe it's a future guest.
So let me just approach all radio programmers out there.
Yeah, maybe it's a radio program.
Programmers, if you're looking to shift things around and you need some negotiation and you want to sleep with Tim to help us get our way to the top, just give him a call at 612.
No phone number. Send an email with pictures. I'd like to see you in all your glory so I can make a full rounded decision on this deal. Yeah.
Well, this week, love stinks, Tim, in our true crime, dumb crime, stupid criminals category. Mm-hmm. So far, we've got some bad things happening. Right. Rapper's wife lopping him into parts and salting his pieces.
Good God.
We've got, the beautiful athletic instructor flight attendant who beat the hell out of her man with a guitar.
Yeah.
Or beat the hell out of a man with her bare fists and then smashed his guitar. Let me just get that straight.
Right.
Well, we're going to go to Orem, Utah for this next story, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Where an Orem man who told police he had a video evidence of his ex-girlfriend engaging in illicit and illegal activity is now in trouble himself after officers inquired about how he got the video. The man, 28, was charged Tuesday in 4th District Court with voyeurism, which is a Class A misdemeanor, and witness tampering, a third-degree felony. On July 6th, the man went to the Orem Police Department to say he believed his former girlfriend was engaging in prostitution, and then showed the officer video footage that he had recorded from her bedroom showing the victim in her underwear with another man. Charging documents state. That's when the officer asked if the woman knew there was a camera in her room. The man claimed she did know, but when the officer spoke to the woman, she said the ex-boyfriend had sent her an email and told her to tell police that she knew about the camera and to not say anything stupid.
Whoops.
That's according to the charges. The woman said she was not aware that a camera had been placed in the bedroom and that she was, in fact, being recorded. So, you've got a hooker girlfriend, You're running illegal scam of videotaping, but boy, what a hooker. You know, you think your loved one is up to some shenanigans. There's cameras everywhere that you can buy, and then you find out your wife's a prostitute or your girlfriend's a prostitute, and you're trying to do the right thing and be like, wow, look, she's, you know, not only is she cheating on me, but she's prostituting. And then you go to jail. That's kind of a weird, that this poor guy's having a bad week, Tim.
Boy, is he ever.
Yeah, he's having a bad, bad week. But yeah, not as bad as this guy, Tim.
Okay.
Miami man has been arrested after buying a Lamborghini with $4 million of COVID relief aid.
Oh, no.
Florida man is facing charges after authorities say he fraudulently obtained $3.9 million in federal loans meant for small businesses impacted by the coronavirus pandemic and used it to buy a Lamborghini and other personal expenses. David Tyler Hines, age 29 of Miami, was charged Monday with bank fraud, making false statements to financial institution and engaging in transactions in unlawful proceeds, according to a copy of the criminal complaint. Authorities said Hines, in all, requested approximately $13.5 million in Paycheck Protection Program loans. He submitted 7 loan applications in May, which contained numerous false and misleading statements about his alleged moving company's respective payroll expenses. He claimed that his 4 companies paid millions in payroll during the first quarter of 2020, though state and bank records show that his companies had little to no payroll expense during this period. Postal Inspector Brian Musmella said in a complaint, those purported employees either did not exist or earned a fraction of what Hines claimed in his PPP applications, stated Musmella, who also noted that authorities were unable to find any record of operating websites linked to Hines's businesses. Hines' loan request was ultimately approved. He was given $3.9 million, which within days he began spending, authorities say. So this guy got not just one, but multiple loans, Tim.
Gee.
I couldn't get one, nor could I get on unemployment.
Wow.
And this guy is cornering the market. Like 7 loans for $3.9 million?
Hmm.
I was just trying for one loan for $22.7 million. No, well, Dave, we can't get that.
Dave, $22.7 million?
Damn, I got bills. I got bills. I'm just saying.
You get $22.7 million worth of bills?
Yeah, because if I'm ever going to get an exact replica of the 1966 Batmobile, Tim, it ain't going to just show up in my driveway. I need money. So I was going to use part of the money for that and then turn that into a business where I would go do drive-by birthdays during the COVID crisis. And I was planning on charging $120,000 per birthday party. So that would add up quickly to exactly what I was looking for in unemployment. See?
Uh-huh.
It's business, Tim. It's just business.
I see.
If you'd have paid attention in school instead of flirting with the professors, sleeping your way to the top.
Okay. You had to
learn the business ways, but I didn't get my loans at all, Tim.
I see. Well, it might have been a reason. Yeah.
Hines' spending spree allegedly included the purchase of a 2020 Lamborghini Huracan sports car for approximately $318,000. He also made thousands of dollars in payments to dating websites, jewelry stores, luxury clothing retailers, as well as to the Miami Beach resorts. 2 payments totaling $30,000 were also documented as going to mom, according to the criminal complaint. At least he did the right thing and sent $60,000 to mom.
Aww. Only $60,000, yeah. Though. He could dish out $318,000 for a Lamborghini, but Ma got a paltry $60,000.
And don't forget multiple thousands to dating sites. How? Now you're a millionaire, $3.9 million. You don't have to work that hard, son. You're a good looking fella.
There's a tuned up cuckoo guitar swinging lady over in, where did you say again? Who's looking for a guy?
tuned up cuckoo guitar slinging lady.
I made her sound
that that sounds like a Kinks album from the
60s. It does. I made her sound like El Cabong.
Yeah.
But she's raring to go, and you could take her for a ride in her in your new El Cabong, in your new
Lamborghini.
Yeah, Lamborghini. Sorry, I was just got this vision of the two of them swinging on a rope. I distracted myself. I mean, you know, you can save yourself some cash there. Just saying.
The bank accounts listed as belonging to his moving companies were closed on June 24th. $3.4 million was seized from the accounts at the time of his Friday arrest. Authorities said businesses must use PPP loan proceeds for payroll costs, interest on mortgages, rent, and utilities, the Department of Justice said in a release announcing Hines's charges. The PPP allows the interest and principal to be forgiven if businesses spend the proceeds on these expenses within a set time period and use at least a certain percentage of the loan towards payroll expenses. Well, if it's a payroll loan and payroll costs, why is only a percentage need to go to payroll expenses? Shouldn't it all go to your employees? And, you know, a portion of your rent and stuff like that. I don't know. That just sounds weird to me. Anyway, I got problems. What am I going to say? I'm never going to get a 1966 Batmobile now either, because dicks like this have ruined it for the rest of us hardworking scam artists, Tim.
I guess so.
Hines was released Monday, though, on a $100,000 bond during his first court appearance, rather. He is being allowed to stay at his mom's home with a GPS monitor. His next arraignment is scheduled for October 14th.
Well, I think for $60,000, his rent is paid for a while.
Wow. I'm sure they took it back. Boy, how do you do that? Now, Mom, so this is a bit of a double whammy. Your little boy, who loves you and sent you $60,000, needs it back, and I need to live with you now.
Can you just see the look on her eye?
Well, here's the story.
Just the, do I have to? No, I was going to take the bridge club out to Baker Square for lunch.
How many times do you think she sat there looking at the cup of coffee she was about to make him and looking at the rat poison and then the coffee?
And probably quite a bit.
Well, this story should have gone a little bit earlier, but I guess we're going to jump back into Love Stinks on today's Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals, Tim.
All right.
Where a Monroe County woman has been arrested for allegedly trying to hire a hitman to kill her ex-husband. Love hurts. Michigan State Police say a 51-year-old South Rockwood woman was arrested last week for allegedly trying to hire a hitman to kill her ex-husband. Wendy Ween, it's very unfortunate, allegedly contacted a fake website called rentahitman.com.
Yeah, I think that stinks of a scam right there.
You think so?
Yeah, I don't.
You think any website that actually has hitman in it might be a red flag?
The only one that would hold up would be the Brett the Hitman Hart website. That's the only one that would be. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to offer to pay, you know, him to have somebody murdered either.
Yeah, unless
I'm betting they're monitoring that stuff.
Unless he put him in the sharpshooter for a couple of days, I don't think.
So the website claims to offer hitmen to solve problems. Dirty deeds done cheap. Ween allegedly filled out a service request form on the website and requested a consultation to help with the issue, saying her ex-husband was the target. The owner of the website then contacted Michigan State Police because he was concerned that Ween was trying to kill her ex-husband. Well, really, dipshit, you put up a website offering to do it, then you're concerned when people are trying to take you up on it? An undercover state trooper posed as a hitman went and met Ween in a parking lot in South Rockwood. She offered him $5,000 to murder her ex, who lives in another state, and provided him with an upfront payment for travel expenses. Ween was later arrested and charged with solicitation to commit murder and was lodged at the Monroe County Jail. The owner of the website said that since he started it in 2005, he has been contacted numerous times by people requesting murders, school shootings, and claims that it has prevented more than 130 murders, as he refers all requests to law enforcement. Ooh, good thing we found that out now, Tim.
Yeah, woo!
I had to hire a hitman to whack me. or off me or whack off me. I don't know, whatever you're going to have him do.
Maybe whack you off, but not whack you. I know it gets rough there on the road there, Dave, so, you know, I send a big burly man out there to take care of you.
Uh-huh. Here's some more love gone wrong, Tim.
Okay.
A nude couple walking their dog has been busted after a violent tangle with Massachusetts cops. Just let that marinate for a second, Tim.
I'm doing that.
A nude couple tangled with police after they were spotted strolling with their dog early Monday morning near the Massachusetts home. Hmm. Responding to 911 calls about the naked duo, cops encountered the couple around 6:30 a.m. Investigators say that Mariel Kinney, age 32, and Kevin Pinto, age 30, were accompanied by their dog Lucy as they walked near their home in Hopkintown, a town 30 miles west of Boston. When police questioned Kinney and Pinto about the state of undress, the pair allegedly became confrontational after answering some questions incoherently. After yelling and swearing at police, the couple sought to run away from officers, but were quickly corralled. What followed, cops charge, was a violent scrum during which Kinney and Pinto struck Hopkinton Police Department officers, one of whom required treatment for minor injuries. Wow. Pictured in this article, Kinney and Pinto were eventually restrained and placed into custody. They were each charged with indecent exposure, assault, and battery on a police officer, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, and disturbing the peace. The couple has not yet been assigned or arraigned on the felony and misdemeanor counts in district court. It wasn't the typical day in Hopkintown, that's for sure, Police Chief Joseph Bennett told the local paper. They were both buck naked. In fact, Hopkintown, which is the starting point for the Boston Marathon, was named this month as the country's second safest city by Safewise, the home security firm. Wow. Huh. Well, it is safe. It's just naked people walking around.
Yeah, just taking a little stroll.
Here's the thing. Maybe their rights are in violation. Maybe they need to call Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law.
Ooh, I got to do this one. Yeah, yeah.
Because they didn't hassle the dog for being naked.
Oh, come on.
I'm just saying that seems a little unfair to me.
Oh, come on.
Here's another question for you. Why, when Scooby-Doo's collar comes off, does he cover his groin?
I never noticed that before. Really?
Yeah. Donald Duck, when his shirt pops off, he covers his groin as well. You know, come to think of it, Daffy Duck lost that ring around his neck in one episode. He covered his groin. I don't understand that correlation. They like their collars or shirts go off, the rest of them still naked, and they decide to cover their groin. That's bizarre. Very bizarre.
That's a good question.
Here's a guy who took love to a different level.
All right.
Instead of Love Stinks, we're going to go with a Billy Squire song for this one, Tim.
The Stroke?
That's right. Meet Stephen Lee Donovan, Tim, the 22-year-old pizza delivery man. Let that marinate as well. The 22-year-old pizza delivery man was allegedly pleasuring himself Tuesday night while seated behind the wheel of his 1996 Honda Civic parked outside of Circle K in Fruitland Park, Florida, while Donovan was flogging the dolphin, we'll say, Tim. A woman whose car was parked next to the Honda noticed that the vehicle's sole inhabitant had his
pepperoni
appendage.
Out.
Yeah, had his appendage in his hand and was stroking himself. Unfortunately for Donovan, the witness was an off-duty cop from a neighboring city. She copied down the Honda's license plate, which she subsequently provided to police dispatchers. A Fruitland Park Police Department report notes that a review of surveillance footage captured the suspect, who wore a black mask, pulling his pants down as he grabs his genital areas and making a continual motion with his genital area. Cops tracked the vehicle to a residence where they found Donovan, who works for a Hungry Howie's pizza franchise. I would be making sure that he is not my delivery guy going forward. And Maxine Monroe, his 20-year-old girlfriend, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
During questioning, Donovan reportedly told police that he drove to the Circle K at around 10 p.m. to grab a post-work drink. And boy, there's nothing that gets you more sexually excited than a Slurpee, right?
Yeah, yeah.
After Donovan placed himself at the scene of the masturbation, he was arrested and placed in handcuffs. It was at this point that Monroe asked to speak with Donovan, who was in the rear of the patrol car. During the couple's conversation, which was recorded by a dash cam, Donovan was very apologetic to Maxine, cops reported, acknowledging that he was horny and was masturbating to pornography. Donovan advised Maxine that he didn't think masturbating in his own car was illegal. Just let that made. Yeah. I was, you know, here's something, right? We definitely know it's illegal to masturbate in somebody else's car.
Yes. Well, it's right. out in public.
at least he was kind of aware. Sadly, Donovan apparently did not further expound on his belief that a Honda's interior was some kind of sovereign nation. Charged with exposure of sexual organs, a misdemeanor, Donovan was booked into Lake County Jail. You know what? He needs to call me, Tim.
Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law.
Here's why, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's voyeurism. Why was that woman looking into his car? What kind of dirty pervert looks in other people's cars anyway? He needs to countersue that quote-unquote off-duty officer. This fellow was in his car playing whack-a-mole in his Honda Civic, which I believe, according to the peace accords of 1923, allows for such things to happen, Tim.
Peace accords of 1923. Yes.
Yeah. When you can't get a peace, you either go to a Honda or an Accord. Isn't that what the peace accord was all about?
It isn't a stealth bomber. It's a Honda Accord.
Well, it kind of was.
You know,
Until the missile left the silo, I guess, was the problem.
Off duty doesn't mean it's her duty to please that booty. It just means that, you know, if she sees something, say something.
And she's being voyeuristic, looking in the windows. That's kind of a violation of his privacy. I'm just saying. How much do you think he had to post to get out of jail?
I'm going to go $500.
$500?
Yep.
Top three answers on the board. 100 people surveyed. Show me $500.
No.
Two chances left to win, Tim. Otherwise, it goes over to the Schrader family.
I'll go $1,000, Dave. I didn't think it was that big of a...
Show me $1,000. Bing, 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 bing. Number one answer, Tim. Number one answer. $1,000. Grand. Crazy, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a lot more than I would have thought. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, here's another fellow who decided to buy an expensive car, Tim. And not just that, but a couple of Rolex watches. Grand Theft Auto, Wewahichikata, isn't a real thing. I don't know. This is a town, I guess. Wewahichika. Wewahichika.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? Grand Theft Auto, Wewahichita. God's sakes, forget it. It's not a thing, though a Florida man allegedly tried to make it one, per the Northwest Florida Daily News. Authorities in Walton County say Casey William Kelly purchased a Porsche 911 Turbo from a dealership in Destin on Monday for nearly $140,000. Purchased, however, may have been too loose a word to describe the transaction, as the $139,203.05 cashier's check that the 42-year-old man presented bounced him. Hard to believe. That size would bounce.
Yeah.
And then the car was reported stolen. Investigators say Kelly was arrested Wednesday, and he told authorities that the check hadn't actually come from the bank, but was simply printed off his home computer. So really, it's his computer's fault for not having money stored away for this kind of occasion.
Sure.
I'm Tim Schrader, defense attorney at law. Before he was nabbed, Kelly made one other stop on Tuesday. His arrest report noted to a Miramar Beach jewelry store where he ponied up another phony check in the amount of $61,521 to pay for three Rolex watches. This time, however, the jeweler held on to the watches to make sure the check cleared first. It didn't. Kelly now faces charges of grand theft of a motor vehicle and uttering a false banknote. uttering a false bank note. That's a weird terminology. First of all, who takes checks anymore?
You know, there are some higher end retail stores that do, because it's hard to wire that much money within a timely fashion. So they do take a check.
A handwritten check, I don't know. For $139,000, that just seems like, you know what, let's run this through first. Or could you go get us a certified check or bank money order? I don't know. That would be my guess.
Well, because a cashier's check only goes to a certain amount of money. So you can only wire a certain amount of money. So
Look at you. You're a financial nerd.
Yeah, according to the resolution, a certified check can only be so much money.
I didn't know you knew so much about financial institutions, Tim.
You know. So you could write a check and they could they could issue you the merchandise right there.
Uh-huh.
Or they could say, you know, we'll take it. Supposedly a cashier's check is supposed to be good for whatever you're writing it out for.
Right.
But
see, had I given the check for $61,000 and they said, well, we're going to hold this check and your watches, come back in 3 days, I'd have said, you know what, give me the check. Have a good day. I wouldn't have left my fake check with them. This guy's just a moron and deserves jail time.
Right.
An employee at a Florida Burger King lost his life because someone didn't receive their order fast enough.
Oh, no.
According to the Orange County Sheriff's Office, a 22-year-old Desmond Joshua was allegedly shot in the parking lot of an Orlando, Florida Burger King by Kelvis Rodriguez Tormez, 37, this past Saturday, because a woman he knew got tired of waiting for her drive-through order. The unnamed woman was refunded $40 and asked to leave by Burger King employees. She reportedly got out of a car, screamed about getting her man to come to the fast food joint, according to WKMG. The woman lived up to that threat, driving away only to reportedly return later with Rodriguez Tormez, who sought out Joshua for a fight. An arrest report noted that the two tussled in the parking lot, with Rodriguez Tormez placing Joshua in a headlock before being separated by a witness. You got 2 seconds before I shoot you, he allegedly told Joshua before going to his truck to get a gun, returning to pull the trigger over fast food, Tim.
Jeez. It's not worth it.
People are idiots. Just plain and simple, people are idiots. Yep. But you know who else are idiots, Tim?
What's that?
Emus.
Like Lemu Emu and Doug from the insurance commercial?
Yeah, it's a story enough to make a grown man cry, being banned from the local pub, Tim. Well, now two emus, flightless birds that roam the Australian outback, understand the feeling. They've been blacklisted for rowdy behavior at the only pub in the town of Yaraka, which has a population of 15 people. The establishment was forced to erect barricades to stop the birds from entering after they became just a little too comfortable. Yaraka Hotel publican Chris Gimblett told ABC the birds recently ventured into the pub after learning how to climb stairs. The animals, named Carol and Kevin, were rescued from an abandoned nest by a local and hatched with the help of an electric blanket. And now they're out of control, Tim. Mr. Gimblett explained, we didn't really want them becoming patrons in the hotel because when they do get in there, they behave a bit badly.
Aww.
Their toileting inside is not particularly present or pleasant. That means pooping and peeing, Tim, if they just, you know, deuce and weese right there.
Aww.
That's the biggest problem because they do toilet quite frequently. He added, when emus get a fright, they head in a forward direction but are normally looking behind so they can't see where they're going, and this is where chaos can happen.
I do the same thing. I just start running and I look behind me and I run into stuff.
Pub staff erected a barrier at the front door which shows the curious birds. They have been banned for bad behavior. Oh, they're cute though.
How about an emu diaper? That would solve so many things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sign instructs human patrons to enter the barrier, warning them to reattach the rope to keep the emus out. So the emus have figured out how to get in and walk upstairs. Now you're worried that they can't lift a rope with their beak and let themselves in?
Yep.
Yep. Mr. Gimblett said the emus have been waiting near the barrier for a forgetful patron to slip up. But so far, we are winning that war, he said. It's like an emu zombie apocalypse. The emu is one of the largest birds in the world, second only to the ostrich. They can travel long distances and can reach speeds of nearly 30 miles an hour. The bird features on the Australian coat of arms alongside the kangaroo, Tim, symbolizing a nation moving forward. Both species of animal cannot move backwards easily. That's just a little bit of FYI for our listeners, Tim.
It's like the shittiest emu club ever. Nine? Nine?
If you poop or pee on the floor, apparently you're not welcome in an Australian pub where there's only 15 people in town. Well, Tim, we wrap up today's Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals with the strangest headline. Hostage siege ends after Ukrainian president endorses Joaquin Phoenix movie. A gunman in the Ukraine, armed with an automatic rifle and grenades, has surrendered to police and released 13 hostages after the country's president consented to his demand to recommend the 2005 animal rights documentary Earthlings, narrated by Joaquin Phoenix. The niche film recommendation delivered by President Volodymyr Zelensky over Facebook helped end an hours-long standoff in the western Ukrainian city of Lutsk, where 44-year-old Maxim Kirosh seized a bus and demanded that dozens of government officials admit to being terrorists. During the hostage crisis, which began on Tuesday morning, Kirovish opened fire and threw a grenade at a police drone. The reports of automatic gunfire sent some journalists at the scene diving for cover. No one was seriously injured during the standoff. A bullet was reported to have nearly struck the national chief of police. The gunman also spoke with journalists and monitored social media during the hostage crisis. Although his Twitter account was eventually deactivated, Tim, because Twitter ain't having it.
Nope.
One hostage who spoke with a journalist by telephone during the crisis begged them to put the gunman in touch with the president's office. Zelensky spoke directly with Kirzhov, a spokeswoman said, after which three of the hostages were released from the bus. The rest were released shortly after he posted a short video online about a Joaquin Phoenix film critical of poor treatment of animals. The film Earthlings from 2005, everyone should watch it, Zelensky said in the video released over Facebook. It was deleted after Kryvash surrendered and replaced with a large note thanking police and others who helped to end the crisis. Human life is the most important value. We have not lost anyone, Zelensky wrote. Kirovash is an animal rights activist. Local media reported he also spent nearly a decade in prison on fraud and weapons charges and was described by police as unstable after the incident. You think so?
Oh, yeah.
At least he didn't go in there and make people have to watch the Joker movie.
You weren't a fan, huh?
It was okay. I just, you know, that's one that, like, it would seem to me that would be what a crazy man would make you, the president, endorse.
You would think, yeah.
Yeah. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah. Sometimes I'm wrong. Sometimes I'm so right that it's scary. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to just leave the rest of these stories for next week so that we have some more stories, Tim.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, because we've got a lot going today. We've got a great show with Steve, and now we've got so many fantastic Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals. I feel we should just go out on a high note. What do you say?
Sure, sounds good to me.
All right, well, that's it for this week, kids. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is True Crime Tuesday.